We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are welcoming back a return guest, an old friend of the pod. He is an award-winning book reviewer and the editor of Chess Life magazine, of course, known as a chess bibliophile. I think he's managing to keep up with the chess books despite his role of putting out Chess Life magazine every month. He's also a dad, an improver, a four-time guest of the pod, nipping at Greg Shahady and Kostya Kavutsky and Christopher Chabri and the other frequent guests. And we have a few other repeat guests coming your way, great authors and world championship previews and stuff like that coming up. So we're going to welcome back some old friends, starting with John Hartman. John, what's new?
Hey, Ben, anything interesting happened in the past 18 months?
Well, I had to call an emergency podcast because I couldn't find the October edition of Cover Stories with Chess Life. So that's big news in the chess world.
So sometimes people are hard to pin down for recording, especially when they're very busy. So we took a month off in October, but at the moment I am scheduled to record our November Cover Story podcast on Monday with Alex Lenderman.
Okay.
So, yes. Our November issue features Alex's his story of his U.S. Open. Really, really interesting stuff. Good analysis. And I'll be interested to talk to him, especially coming off his really good performance at the U.S. Championship.
Yeah. Shout out to Alex. I know it seems like he's been working hard at his chess, and it's nice to see him still grinding, and it'll be good to read about it and hear him on the podcast. And obviously I didn't think it was the host's mistake that there was no cover stories.
But I think you can attribute a good chunk of the blame to me.
It's very, very kind of you to fall on the sword. The first topic I wanted to talk about with you, John, first of all, I should direct listeners to our prior interviews. We had one sort of at the dawn of the pandemic last year was our most recent interview, which I'll link to in the show description. And, you know, you described some, first of all, you were kind of new to the editor at Chess Life role, and you also arrived at a critical moment for U.S. chess as all tournaments were suddenly shut down, which was obviously a major revenue stream. So I was hoping to get sort of an update on your role and U.S. chess generally. You can do whichever you want first, John.
I guess let's start with U.S. chess because, last June, a big, big chunk of me talking on the show was sort of trying to make the case for why to renew your membership. U.S. chess is a 501c3, but we are funded quite a bit by our by our members, by the dollars they pay to become US Chess members, to have the right to have an official rating, to receive Chess Life or Chess Life Kids. And yet it was a pretty scary time, as I think, scary for everybody, but especially scary for a nonprofit who's suddenly seeing tournaments not happening anymore. Our membership before the pandemic was in the high 90,000s. In fact, at the 2019 US Open, we were talking about running some sort of special promotion to reward the 100,000th person who became a US Chess member. And then the bottom fell out. I think when we did bottom out, I think we ended up with somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 members. So we're talking about half of our revenue stream gone within a matter of months. And it was scary. It was very scary, but because of decisions that were made by the executive board over the years, over the past number of years, we had a rainy day fund to be ready for times when it rained. And boy, did it rain. Between some, decisions about, tightening our belts and, for example, with Chess Life, we cut our page count and things like that. Between those sorts of decisions and really the critical PPP loans from the government, from the U.S. government, U.S. Chess survived. And right now we're seeing our membership begin to turn back up. The last number I saw was somewhere in the mid 60,000s. So like 63,000, 64,000, which is a nice uptick from now that tournaments are coming back and things like that. I'm very, very happy about how we weathered the storm. And I think we've got good things to look to coming in the future.
Great to hear. Yeah, obviously, you hear a lot anecdotally about good turnouts at tournaments here in the U.S. So hopefully it might even produce a sort of more vibrant membership where more people are playing actively and hopefully stick with it for a long time. So I'm glad to hear that the finances are looking better. Obviously, we had the big donation from John Rockefeller. Shout out to John Rockefeller seeding additional tournaments, and I'm sure that doesn't hurt either. So glad to hear that all is well on the USCF front. And what about the editing Chess Life magazine front, John?
Well, there was one part of that I do want to talk about because certainly the Rockefeller donation is huge for the history of US chess. For those who are unaware, John Rockefeller, who is he's one of us. I mean, he's a chess guy, which is really what I appreciate about this. He's a scholastic director in Maryland. He's on the scholastic committee for US chess. He has endowed some of our national invitational tournaments that are part of the sort of US Open landscape. And they're creating some new ones as part of it. So what I think that's a really good example of is something that US Chess saw during this time period is that donations have really not only helped us, weather the storm, but have grown. People are donating. And I think there's two reasons for that. I think people are seeing the work that US Chess is trying to do, growing chess. I mean, Jen Chahadi, all her work with women in chess and girls in chess, the expansion we've done with online chess, the return of over the board chess and our place in that landscape. I think people are seeing the value we have. And in particular, when you go through an experience like a pandemic, I think we're up to 750,000 Americans have died at this point. We've all gone through something, and I think for a lot of us, it's helped us reorder the things that are important in our lives. People see that, chess as a hobby, as a pastime, as an educational tool, people see the value of that. And I think when they see the value of that, they want to be a part of making it grow. And the donations have been, I mean, astonishing. I can't say enough thank yous to the John Rockefellers of the world, but also to the people who were sending in, you know, $500 donations. That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that helps us grow. It's been so rewarding and gratifying to see that and to be a part of it. I couldn't be happier.
That's good to hear. So what's on the agenda? I mean, obviously you guys weathered a storm, so you might not be in the like expanding CapEx point of the cycle. I'm not sure. But like, what are the big projects that US Chess wants to tackle, John?
Well, I think right now the big thing that's coming up is the K-12, the Great Nationals, which will be in Orlando in December. And then the sort of return of our full slate of scholastics in the spring, which I think is going to be great to see. As you said, you know, tournament numbers have been up everywhere. The National Open was huge. The U.S. Open was tremendous. You know, lots and lots of people came to New Jersey for that. So, you know, getting these big tournaments back is one thing. I think we've learned quite a bit about our place in the online world, both in terms of running online tournaments. So we, you know, organizers now have the ability to run official US Chess rated online events where people can get a online rating that is cross-platform. So, you know, if you're playing tournaments on Lee Chess or on chess.com or chessclub.com, you know, the rating that you get there, it will be good for any of those things. We made some mistakes at the beginning. Some of the first scholastics we tried to run, they were just too big for the infrastructure we had at the time, but we learned from that. And the scholastics that we ran later were much more successful, I think. You know, I mean, we made mistakes, but I think that's been a big area of growth. And, you know, certainly as Chess Life editor, I have learned an awful lot. you know, not just about the nuts and bolts of it, about, you know, how the sausage gets made, but about putting together magazines that I think people want to read, and giving our readers a, you know, a vibrant, attractive piece of mail that they get every month that they can enjoy. Like everybody, I've learned about me, about, you know, what's important to me. You know, it's God, I mean, don't you feel that way, Ben, that like, this is, As awful as this has been, it's been a good chance for reflection.
It's been a big shakeup in my professional and family life, and yeah, it definitely recenters your priorities for sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting times. Hopefully we're moving past them though.
I cannot wait to get my booster.
Yeah.
So Chess Life, we should talk about Chess Life because I am actually, for the first time in 18 months, I'm getting a short break. I don't have to work next week. I am super excited about this.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we just put the December issue to bed. We sent it to the printer. And we have to do that a little bit early because I don't think it's going to happen because of some ongoing issues with the U.S. Postal Service and some backups with the printer. But, you know, our goal is to get this issue in people's hands by Thanksgiving because it's got the annual sales catalog from US Chess Sales bundled with it. So we had to get that to the printer early, and now I get some time off, which is nice. Chess Life, I mean, I think anyone who takes a look at the magazine right now and, you know, US Chess members, every US Chess member can read it online for free. With our current membership structure, any US Chess member can pay what amounts to like a $10 surcharge to have the magazine mailed to them every month. Which I still think, you know, when you figure in the membership fee for adults, it's $45 for the year plus $9.45, I think, to receive the print magazine. If you compare that to, let's say, New in Chess or to American Chess Magazine, I think we're offering great value for the dollar. We're half the price and you get double the issues, which is kind of nice. But we're putting out a really pretty magazine too. We've got a new art director, Corey Kennedy, every issue, he just blows my mind. You know, for people who saw the July issue with John Donaldson on the cover, he directed this photo shoot with John Donaldson at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco, and just iconic photography in that story. And then for our December issue, which people should get probably around December 1st, maybe a little bit later, we've got a piece by Mike Klein, which is one of the most thoughtful, pensive pieces about chess and age and growing and improvement. And we got some art for that, which is just so absolutely beautiful. I put it in the center of the magazine because it's so beautiful. It's not the cover story, but it's what you open to when you open the magazine. I'm so excited for people to see this.
Cool. Rumors are swirling that Mike Klein will be heard from on Perpetual Chess during the World Championship. So shout out to Mike.
We'll have to send you a preview of his piece, which is called Different Wavelengths.
Okay.
I think next year when the Chess Journalists of America meet, I think this is going to be winning awards. It's that good.
Excellent. Cool. Well, I mean, lots to look forward to. It sounds like you're figuring stuff out. So was there anything with Chess Life magazine that you excised? I mean, I don't want you to like put anyone on blast necessarily, but how do you get a sense of like what readers maybe like what tastes have evolved? Let's put it that way.
I think, so it's funny. If you look back at Chess Life from like the mid 90s, there are 10 or 12 regular columns or departments. You know, we have reduced that. Some of that is by people's choice. Well, I mean, all of it really is ultimately by people's choice. You know, like Lev Albert's column, Back to Basics. Lev decided to retire his column, and we have not replaced it as of yet. Daniel Naroditsky's inheritance of Hal Benko's Endgame column, that is no longer in the magazine, largely because, you know, Danya decided that it just was not something that he could commit as much time to. Those columns I would like to see come back in some shape or form. I have some ideas about who I would like to take them over. We haven't done it yet just because of the finances and because right now, you know, due to printing paper shortages and still coming out of the pandemic and the pandemic finances, we're still at 60 pages. And in the past, we've usually been anywhere from 68 to 72. So we just don't have as many pages right now, you know, to print on as I would like. That said, you know, I feel like adding Carsten Hansen's tactics column has been a very popular thing. I get a lot of good feedback about that from, you know, internally and externally, we'll put it that way. I think pieces like Sam Shankland on the World Cup.
That was great. Yeah.
You know, I think that's one of my favorite things that we've printed so far. It's because it's not only him doing really sort of high level analysis, but it's also him in his typically frank, no nonsense way, letting you know exactly why he did things, what his thought process was, and being brutally frank about where he thinks he came up short. It's just raw and honest, and I love it.
I mean, I always enjoy Chess Life, but continue to enjoy it. And as you mentioned, the Sam Shankland pieces in particular, he has a unique style that I always enjoy reading. But John, we want to talk about chess books. From your humble beginnings, an expert of chess books, and I think somehow, I don't know how, you still managed to read some. But before we dive in, John, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by ChessMood.com. ChessMood was founded in 2018 by Grandmaster Avchik Grigorian. It's a chess education platform that gives you a structured path to work to improve your chess. For $29 a month, you get instant access to over 200 hours of Grandmaster prepared video content and includes openings, middle games, and end games. They also have an active online community where you can find training partners and fellow chess enthusiasts. Don't forget to check out their free free content. They have a great blog where their grandmasters share their own thoughts on chess improvement. I get it delivered to my inbox. So to learn more about Chess Mood and what they offer, be sure to check out their website, chessmood.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And we are back. So, John, let's start with the truth. How much are you able to read now as compared to when it was your job, when your primary role with US Chess was to review books?
Not as much. There are a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is the simple fact that I don't get as many review copies showing up on my door as I once did. Today, the books go to John Watson, who is our book reviewer, my good friend and mentor, John Watson. And I think he's doing an excellent job. His December column, I think it's about Dvoretsky's, the fast track edition of Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual. I mean, he's got a lot of thoughts about endgame primers, which books to look at, and how to place this in the endgame landscape. So that was really useful for me to read as well. It actually made me rethink what I want to do in terms of my own improvement plan.
Which we'll get to.
Yes, or lack thereof. I try to keep up with the chess books, not only because, it's an interest, but I'm a collector. I mean, I collect chess books. That's one of my things. And I'm buying them. I'm reading them as I can. It's certainly not as focused to read. My takes are a little more impressionistic than they were. It's funny. Being the editor of a chess periodical has really changed the way that I look at chess books. Being, responsible for putting together material for a wide range of audience has changed the way I look at chess books. And in what I'm about to say, I'm sure that a lot of listeners are going to say, so what? These are not my concerns. I just want to read interesting things, and I don't care about the things John is talking about. And that's okay. I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate viewpoint on chess literature and the sort of chess publishing landscape. But I got to tell you, Ben, I'm not really that excited about the chess books I'm seeing. I'm kind of troubled by some of it. And I think part of it has to do with a change in the chess publishing landscape. I mean, I think publishers are struggling to, like traditional publishers, like print publishers, are trying to figure out how to stay relevant in a chessable world, in a Twitch world, in a YouTube world. But it's also something where I think people are forgetting how important editing is. There are chess books out there right now that, frankly, if my name was on them, I would be embarrassed. I would be mortified if my name was on some of these books. Because there is no editing going on. There is no value add. Some of them, if you are used to looking at chessbase files and seeing how they convert to text files, like in chessbase, when you click on a game and do export to whatever, export to text, export to RTF, if you know what that looks like, you can literally see it in these books. Like, that is a problem to me. And it should be a problem to anyone who loves chess literature. Like, there are titles out there, and I'm hesitant to name names because it's not the author's fault. It's the editor's fault. They did not edit the book. There are style problems on every page. Like, how do you represent the number 10? Do you represent it as numerals or do you represent it as a word?
I go with the Roman numeral.
The third option. I didn't think of that. That's a very obscure style. I will say, most places will represent 1 through 10 as numbers. 1 through 9 is numbers. All right. Basically, you just have to decide how to do it and then stick to it. There are books out there where I'm finding going back and forth on this on the same page. Okay, so I'm looking at your face as we talk here, and I can see you're sort of thinking, well, who cares?
Well, no, I'm thinking that is absolutely something I would do as a writer, and I would hope that someone would catch it.
And that's the thing, is that like the editor should be there to catch it. Or, you know, there are books out there that are clearly not edited by someone who is a native English speaker. If you're publishing in English, the English should be grammatically correct. It should not have nonsensical phrases. And there are books out there that's not the case. There's one book I know. I know for a fact that the author had to hire their own editor to fix the problems that the in-house editors created. All right. So why is this a problem? I'm thinking there's a guy on Amazon who is taking old chess books like Oiva and Prynne's book on Capablanca, and they're translating it using Google Translate. And then they're putting it up on Google, on Amazon for sale as a Kindle book. And there are people in the chess book reviewer, the chess book collectors group who are like, oh, this is really exciting. Here's a book that's in English, like that isn't in English before. It's this famous book, and isn't it nice? And my response is, you people deserve better. Like, here is somebody who is exerting minimum effort, who is literally running text through a computer and then putting it into Amazon's, you know, ebook format. And then they're selling it to you, and you're getting a shoddy product. And it bothers me. Like, I don't know. I suspect most people here are going to turn this podcast off because it's gotten really into a downer. But, you know, I think people deserve better literature. I really think that.
Well, I mean, if we talk big picture, this is a topic that has come up on the podcast over the years. Like, I remember the fourth interview of Perpetual Chess that I did, I believe it was, with Kostya Kavutsky. He was saying he was kind of bearish on chess books as a medium, and his Chess Dojo compatriot, Jesse Cry, has been kind of all over that as well, even though he's old like us and loves chess books. But he's just saying from the kids he works with, he just doesn't see that much interest in books. And obviously, you know, as you mentioned, Chessable is putting out tons of content, a lot of it excellent. And the revenue sharing is better for the creator than chess books are. You have the ability to update it over time, which a lot of the authors are quite active doing. So I guess what I'm saying, I feel your sadness and I get that, but like, it's not that surprising and not that different than like what you hear outside of the chess world, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. And a lot of what I've been thinking, honestly, is prompted by this book by a Stanford professor, Mark McGurl, where he's talking about the Amazonification of fiction. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, basically his take is that essentially fiction has become completely genre driven because of Amazon, because Amazon's trying to sell you things that you want to buy. And, you know, I mean, Chessable is a really interesting example of this as well, because, you know, on the one hand, they very clearly identified a marketing process that works, right? Anish Giri tweeting for them and selling their product apparently is working. And, you know, anecdotally, I'm hearing, you know, top players saying that they are seeing the Chessable effect in the repertoires of young players. Like, you know, there are young players out there who they know play the Nidorf, so they go ahead and check Chessable courses on the Nidorf, like the Geary one, to see what they're going to face. That said, does anyone really need 35 hours on the Win Hour? I mean, does anyone really need 35 hours of video on the Win Hour? Is that going to help anyone who is not Anish Giri improve? I don't know. Is the gamification of study really that useful? like, I mean, it's useful to get you to come back to the website, but does that really help somebody improve? I don't know. And so, you know, we're at a place right now where like chess publishing is just, it's turning into whatever is next. And there are great things about that, but you know, I also worry about that. Like Willy Hendrix's book, the last one he did about chess history, not the move first, think later, but the
On the Origin of Good Moves.
Yeah. Now that's a book that doesn't fit the chessable model that well, right? It's available on there, right? But it's not like, this is not a book for the move trainer.
Right.
Does that book get published 5 years from now? I don't know. Yeah. And for me, that's the thing, is that we're entering a publishing world where opening books get churned out quickly and are money makers, and that's fine. But you know, are we going to lose something in the process? Like,
yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't think they'll disappear. I think that there's still going to be demand for books like that, books that don't necessarily translate to openings, because I think it's opening books that are most vulnerable to chessable usurping them. Yeah. I think books with broader context, historical context, have a better shelf life. And I mean, I don't know the numbers of how any of these publishers are doing, but I mean, a company like Quality Chess seems to just be consistently putting out good books, original books. And I think that a few good companies like that can still carve and maintain a space sort of independent of any move online. But it is, unfortunately, to me, a niche future.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I am increasingly aware that I'm a dinosaur. I was just, you know, I was, but at the same time, I mean, you know, I on Twitter today, friend of the pod, JJ Lang, can we say he's friend of the pod?
Sure.
He's certainly a Twitterati, new Nebraskan. By the way,
Dalton Prover guest.
Nebraska is growing leaps and bounds in chess strength. JJ's just moved here. There is a FIDE master moving here. So it's you know, watch out, because Nebraska may not have been, but pretty soon it's going to be like St. Louis, except without Sinkfield. No, it's not going to be.
Well, you got Warren Buffett, so you just got to get him interested in chess.
He only cares about bridge. Chess is not on his radar. But I mean, you know, today I was, JJ Lang was tweeted something about some student of his, and he said, well, Caruana played this move, and the student's like, who?
Right.
And you know, there is this idea that you should know your chess history, but how is that going to get monetized? I mean, how is that going to fit into this new YouTube chessable sort of, you know, video?
See, I disagree there. It's all over. Like, look at Agat Mater's videos, Levy Rosman covers, you know, he's doing recaps of daily events. Like, you know, if some kid doesn't know who Caruana is, that's on the kid. I think there's broader interest in the chess landscape than ever. I mean, people might lean towards like improving their own games as opposed to you know, chess culture. But there's more interest in chess than ever, and I don't think that's being I don't think that's being supplanted by a lack of writing about it or anything.
That's true, and part of this, you know, part of this is the landscape sort of shaking itself out with all these new players who have come in, who are growing up online, you know, for whom Max Oiva is not only unknown but possibly irrelevant. You know, but it's all, I guess we're sort of living through many epochal shifts, and this is one of them, is that the chess is the online influence, its effects are still being shaken out. And you know, as a lover of literature, as someone who is worried about legacy, I mean, you know, one of the reasons I love Chess Life is that 100 years from now, someone will be able to open that up and read, you know, a nonsense thing I wrote about descriptive notation, or we'll be able to read Sam Shanklin talking about the World Cup, or you know, Robert Shalachenko talking about, who, by the way, you should have him on the pod. He's that kid is incredibly impressive. Great analyst, great player, just made his IM norm. So shout out to Robert if he's listening. You know, some of the articles he's written for us, they're going to be there. Will the YouTube videos? I don't know. I mean, maybe they will, but I mean, is anybody going to watch them? I mean, all right, nobody's going to be reading Chess Life anyway, but.
I just don't know. I mean, YouTube is booming. I don't know what you're talking about.
But it's the churn. I mean, for me, that's the thing is that it's one, like the one thing after another, after another, after another. And then it's ephemeral. It's, you know, maybe there are people who go back and watch all the archives on YouTube, but I think most people are just sort of watching the things that go by day and then they're gone. And then we don't think about them again and we're losing.
I'm not sure. I agree. I think people are searching for specific topics, you know, they get interested in something and they search for it. And then, I mean, yeah, I think YouTube, obviously you're subject to the whims of Google owning them, but
the algorithm. Yeah.
Yeah. But other than that, it seems stronger than ever. I mean, there's so many amazing chess YouTubers who no one's even watching, let alone the ones that people are watching. There's just so much incredible stuff. So, go ahead.
Well, I mean, maybe that just gets into where I'm at a different point in my life. Is that, you know, I am sympathetic to the chess improver hashtag. I don't think of myself as such. I am a chess amateur. I am someone who loves the game, but is not professional, or who is not a pro, or is not strong enough to call themselves. I mean, that's like the literal derivation of the word amateur. I want there to be a place for that in the current discourse. And sometimes I worry that the sort of strictly utilitarian approach to, you know, mining YouTube for the Stafford Gambit so I can trick somebody in a blitz game or something like that, that I don't know what that does to chess culture. And I'm worried about that. Like I want people to want to look at the games of Capablanca, not just because they're useful, but because they're pretty. Or, you know, that game that Alexander, what's his name? Petke?
Oh, for yesterday. Yeah.
This game in the World Cup in the second round of the Grand Swiss, rather, where this guy sacrificed two minor pieces for a queen on like move 12 and then spent the entire rest of the game proving the compensation. You know, I want people to want that. And, you know, I don't know how much room there is that for the, in the landscape today. That I really am an old man, Ben. Like I am like shouting, get off my porch here, get off my lawn. Like me and Jesse Cry are like kindred spirits. Although Jesse Cry, I mean, for all of his Luddite tendencies, man, he has mastered these viral videos, like the one thing in chess you must do. And then it ends up being write, you know, handwrite your notes. And you're like, what? What? Yeah. That's not what I was, but he's doing it. It's the landscape is changing, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, then there's only so much we can do about it. The aforementioned friend of the pod, Christopher Chabrie, I recorded a How to Chess podcast, which you guys should all be subscribed to, even if you're not listening to it. did one on the importance of chess culture. So that's forthcoming in the next month to 6 weeks, but definitely hits on that topic where, like, even if you're focused on improving your own game, you can improve your own game by sort of appreciating the beauty of a Capablanca, but also it just sort of like broadens your perspective. And that's why, you know, I'm still doing book recaps like the one that just dropped as we record today about Korchnoi's biography, in addition to a lot of the sort of more improvement based stuff, because, chess is a rich tapestry and there's no reason to focus on one particular aspect of it. Although, I mean, everyone has limited time too. Yeah. So, you know, more power to you if you pursue that which you find most compelling about the game. You know, just, you know, pick and choose what you like. And John might shake his head, but such is life. There are certainly worse things you could do with your time.
That's, you know, I think the reality of it is that most of us have limited time and we have to pick and choose. And yeah. You know, for me, at the end of the day, I'm tired of chess.
You're also living it. Yeah, it's your job.
It's it's crazy. But so I'm trying to just find like a limited thing that I can do that will help me play more beautiful games. Like I, at this point, certainly I want to win. I mean, certainly I want to crush people like a bug. Let's not pretend that's not true. But if I had to choose between winning dirty and losing a beautiful game, I'm going to take losing the beautiful game. That's just where I'm at in my life. And wow.
Someday I hope I get there.
It's totally a lie, Ben. I'm pulling this out of my tokus. Come on. Yeah. No, but and part of this might be I haven't played over the board chess in 18 months, but I want to think that so long as I do not make horrible mistakes, I will be happy to have played.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to get back to your game in a minute. And I know you're a longtime member of Killer Chess Training. Shout out to Jakob Agard and company. But first, to finish up the book topic, we do have a Patreon mailbag question. Shout out to Alex Friedman. Thanks for supporting the podcast. Alex has been sending in some great questions lately. And I did prep you for this one because otherwise you'd be hemming and hawing for 15 minutes.
No, actually, the answer is simple. The answer is
okay,
very
simple. Okay, I'll ask the question, which is, which chess book was the most helpful for your chess improvement? You can only pick one.
That would be Chess Steps number 4.
Okay.
So the Chess Steps for me, and I've talked about this on appearances before.
Nonetheless, you should say what they are first.
The Chess Steps or the Stappen Method are a series of teacher manuals and student workbooks from the Dutch Chess Federation. It's basically like a... how to get to, how to get to 2100 or 2200 in like one prepackaged course. My chess education was incredibly haphazard. Like most American players of my era, it was like whatever books I could find. And, it was like Reinfeld's 1001 Checkmates and 1001 Tactics and whatever random strategy book I could find. And that was it. The steps give you a very programmed way to look at chess positions. They give you a vocabulary for talking about chess positions. And for me, when I started going through it, because I was frustrated with my game, because I would make, and I still do, stupid tactical blunders, like oversights. Either I would miss something or I would just let something happen. This gave me a way to relearn to see the board. And it's really effective for kids, but I think it's actually very effective as well for adults who just want to learn to see better. So for me, the reason I say number 4 is steps 2 and 3 basically are like basic tactics where you have to see 3-ply, like a double attack. Like you make a move, you attack 2 targets, and on the they do something, and then you win a piece or you go wherever you need to go. Step 4 is where it gets up to 5-ply, like you have to set up the tactic. And for me, that was the most important book I've ever read because it really made me rethink how to think about tactics on a chessboard.
Yeah, I'm doing step 5. I was, what's great about the step series, and I think this is also true of the Yusupov series, which I still haven't really dug into, is that it's, to the extent that it's possible, it's kind of one-stop shopping. I was inspired by FM Peter Giannatos' Adult Improver interview, like a lot of people were. And as I mentioned many times, calculation, I think, is one of the weaker part of my games, at least for my, level. I could have done exactly what Peter recommended, perfect your chess, because actually I'm at the level that he was at when he started it. Mm-hmm. But I still had this sort of nagging sense that there are just little holes in my game throughout that if I just work on these exact calculation problems might not get addressed. Whereas if I start with step 5, which is actually below my level, it's slated ideal in theory for around 2000 level, but, and this is 2000 USCF / FIDE. But I knew that there would be things that I would miss, and I am getting like 80 to 90%, but there's puzzles like stopping a passed pawn, taking advantage of a weak square. And I just, even though my calculation writ large, and there's calculation puzzles on top of that. So even though my calculation is what works, I had a lot of experience teaching the first 3 steps of manuals, but not a lot of experience above that. So anyway, I'm in the same boat as you. I do that and openings, and that way with the manuals, you're getting a little bit of everything. You're getting some end games, some tactics, some positional chess, and obviously you still need to analyze your games as well. But and nothing's perfect. And if you look at, you know, if Alex's question is like, what book that I have read or that you have read contributed to the most rating gain, that's not going to be it, because that's not what I'm, because that's what I'm doing now, you know. Whereas, and now I don't get better at chess, or at least haven't lately.
But, it's about stopping the bleeding. That's really
yeah. When you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. So that's where I'm at right now. But yeah, I mean, I obviously we've showed for the chess steps method before, and will again. But yeah, I mean, there's so many little just like diabolical creative puzzles. I mean, they must have put so much thought into like every single puzzle. It's amazing.
Yeah, I did want to say. Peter Giannatos is his book from New in Chess, the new one, the puzzle, everyone's first workbook. I love it.
Excellent. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, if I were to have like a non-steps workbook that I could give to a student and say, here, do all these puzzles and it will help you. I think that's a really, really solid choice for that sort of thing.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, with Peter in that interview and on How to Chess, it's a great like gift if like a friend of yours is new to chess, knows the rules of checkmate and doesn't know what to do next, it's like a great book for that level. And similar to what we're talking about, if you're at a level where you might be past that but you're worried one aspect of your game might be missing, like it can be good to do that as review and then proceed forthwith from there.
Yeah. I shouldn't be too down on the book publishing world, because there are some really good books out there. You know, Rachmaninoff's Secrets of Opening Preparation from Thinkers Publishing. You know, Thinkers Publishing is very hit or miss. I mean, we have to be blunt. Some of their books I think are not much more than databases turned into a book. This is not that. This is a really interesting book that, you know, sort of gives you an insight into how a guy who plays in the Russian championship thinks about the opening and thinks about it in terms of a world where, you know, everybody's booked up. And like, so how do you respond to that? You play like weird little sidelines, or you play the exchange Slav and you play it for a win. How do you do that? Fascinating book. You know, there's all sorts of books. I shouldn't go into that. But the Giannatos book is a really nice example of what you can still do. Like, I didn't think there was room in the marketplace for another tactics book, but there is. And he created it. And I mean, I hope it really does well.
Yeah, I hope so too. And of course, available on Chessable as well. So John, I do want to bring it back to the your own work on your own game conversation, whether it be as an improver, air quotes, or not. But first, we're going to take one more break and hear from our sponsors. Good news, listeners. According to aimchess.com, I'm now only behind on the clock 75% of the time in my blitz games. That's actually huge progress for me. I'm going to keep working to bring it up, and I recommend you use aimchess.com to address whatever weaknesses you may have in your game, whether it be playing with the white or black pieces, a particular opening, or a particular phase of the game. They give tailored lessons for whatever their algorithm detects, and of course, their algorithm scrapes the games from the major chess playing sites themselves in order to tell you what you need. If you decide to subscribe to aimchess.com after checking it out, be sure to use the promo code perpetual30. Details are in the show notes. Check out aimchess.com. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by our old friends at chessable.com. Hopefully you know by now about their proprietary move trainer technology that helps you remember tactical patterns as well as opening sequences. Whatever aspect of your game you're looking to work on, there is an excellent chance that Chessable has something for you to help. They're also constantly releasing new courses in the pipeline. Currently, they've got a lifetime repertoire 1E4 from none other than Anish Giri, and they've got the Ginger GM, Simon Williams, soon to release a treatment of legendary Grandmaster Alexei Shirov's Fire on Board, plus so much more. So just be sure to always go to chessable.com and take a look at what's new.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And we are back. And John, we had left the conversation talking about both your work in Steps Books and, of course, sort of more generally, maybe an evolution to where you're less focused or at least trying to be less judgmental about improvement, but of yourself, that is. But
I'll be judgy about everything. Don't worry.
But nonetheless, I know you're, as we mentioned, a member of Killer Chess Training. So how much time are you putting into your game and sort of how has your thinking evolved, as you alluded to?
This is a very difficult question because it's funny. I feel very acutely the weight of having to be a decent chess player for my job.
Not, I feel that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not just in terms of like, you know, the face of it, like, oh, the Chess Life editor is a potzer. Like how does that sound? But in terms of, you know, doing the actual work, like, I feel like I need to be a competent chess player and understand what's going on in the world and, you know, be able to make sense of some pretty high level annotations that we get sometimes, like Jakob Augard's, some of the things he's contributed to us, they're really tough. So, I take the improvement question seriously, but as an adult with a 6-year-old at home, and as someone who, you know, during the pandemic had a very serious health challenge, which, you know, for those of you who do not follow me on Twitter, all two of you who are listening, I had a pretty significant thing happen to me. I was diagnosed with a very weird autoimmune problem where basically my body forgot how to eat. And I don't know if it's fair to say I almost died, but it sure felt like that. Yeah, I have this weird thing called achalasia. And so I had to have major surgery in the middle of a pandemic. And that kind of changed my perspective on this. Like, you know, I want to be a good chess player. It's important to me. I also do not have the energy to do that. Like, even now, you know, where I, when this happened, the last time I was on this podcast, I probably weighed 230, 235 pounds, which was not great, but it's what I was. When I had surgery, I weighed 157 pounds.
Wow.
I mean, I wasted away and I still feel the effects of that sometimes. You know, we all have limitations. So what does that mean for improvement? It means I have to be less is more. Like it means I have to be smart about what I'm doing if I want to improve. So for me, I am doing, you know, a couple nights a week, while we're watching TV or when I'm not watching TV, or I put my headphones on and I do problems in the Steps Books. What it means is that when I take my daughter to swim lessons, I take the latest friendly chess homework from Killer Chess Training, and I take it with me and I solve puzzles. You know, I focus on my calculation. I focus on tactics. And then I also do some work on endgames because that's a problem for me. I like to think I'm a good endgame player. The truth of the matter is I'm not. Other than that, and this is just in terms of like personal improvement stuff, because I'm looking at chess games every day for my job. You know, I like games collections. So I have on my desk over there, I've got a chessboard out and I've got Botvinnik's best games. And I'm going to go through that. And if it takes me 2 years, that's okay. Like, I'm going to enjoy it and I'll get something out of it. And if it helps my chess, great. And if it doesn't, at least I'm enjoying it. That's, you know, that's what I can do. And if it's not enough to beat the 8-year-olds, then it's not enough to beat the 8-year-olds. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's only so much you can control. I a lot of that resonates with me. I mean, I'm putting in a bit of time, trying to do a little bit every day. Take a page from, shout out to Neil Bruce. And, you know, ideally I do an hour a day, but some days it's 15 minutes and that's fine.
And that's the thing that, you know, I think all of our fellow chess improvers need to, I think, remember is that you do what you can do. And it's great to build habits where you are doing these things every day. But if it's not possible, then just go easy on yourself because, you know, I mean, we're living in a really twisted time in world history and we're just coming out of something that's been very traumatic for a lot of people. So, you know, if you don't do your 15 minutes of tactics, do it tomorrow. You'll get there. Just, you know, take it easy.
Yeah. And you sent me a note where you'd learned something from Sam Shanklin's lectures in killer chess training.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, look, I mean, we all have to do openings, right? I have stopped by and large stopped buying opening books. And it's not because there's not good opening books out there. There are some excellent ones, but they're too much. Like I do not have time to go through 300 pages on anything. I don't. So instead what I've really taken and again, you know, when we say these things, like I've talked about being a killer chess training member before, I pay for this like everybody else. I'm not getting any special treatment. I do sometimes do seminars for them on chess technology. So like chess engines and building a computer. That was one of my pandemic projects. Thank you to my wife for not killing me for spending way too much money on a chess computer, but I built one. You know, but again, I don't get paid for that. I'm paying my money like everybody else. Shankland has done courses for killer chess, which fundamentally changed the way that I think about opening study. And I think part of the problem, like, I don't know, maybe you have this problem too. Like I would get, opening files from my coach. My friend coach, John Watson, he refused to let me pay him after a certain point, which I think was the most generous thing in the world. I don't know why he would waste his time with me like that, but he did. So he'd say, all right, well here, I did some work on this Nimzo line. Here, take a look at it and maybe you want to play it. And I would look at it and I would study it and I would try to even, you know, do something resembling like spaced repetition. And it just never stuck. Like it just, the ideas didn't make sense. The logic, the internal logic of the various things did not make sense to me. And it wasn't because the file wasn't a good file. It was because I didn't make it. Like I didn't do the work to create the file. So what Shanklin does, and he referenced, like he, you know, when you see him do this, he references Chessable courses. He references books. So he's got these references in there. But basically what he does is he sits down with his incredibly overpowered remote computer. And then he just like builds chess files from scratch using the database and using opening books like in Chessbase or on Lee Chess and things like that. And he just sort of literally works through the theory. That was really impressive to me. Now, I'm not going to build a 2,500 line database like Sam Shanklin has. There is no reason for me to do that. But what I can do is something like I play classical Berlin lines. Not like the Berlin endgame, but I play like the, you know, the knight c6, the knight f6 and bishop c5 lines. What I can do is build out a framework like that and literally just build it by hand. And at the end of that, I'm going to understand it. I may not remember everything, but I'm going to understand it. And for me, like that's the kind of opening study I want to do at this point. I want to learn it. And for me, you know, I mean, the opening books are a great reference. I can't learn from them. Like I can see the moves, but I can't, somehow they don't like magically go in my head. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for me, I feel like maybe the way is just to do the work and just do it. And it's going to stink because it's going to take a lot of time, but you know, I can't say enough about his opening course for killer chess. It like, to watch one of the best prepared players in the world, like build an opening file. I mean, when I say it blew my mind, it literally blew my mind. Like if you want to hear a little bit about what he said, he appeared on Cover Stories with Chess Life a couple months ago.
Yeah, that was a good interview.
He talked a little bit about that, and you can sort of get a flavor of what he does. It's Yeah. Crazy.
And cover stories with Chess Life, we should say, of course, is one of US Chess's monthly chess podcasts. They have four different podcasts that amount to being weekly, which you can subscribe to on separate feeds. We have Chess Underground, Cover Stories with Chess Life, Ladies Night, and Dan Lucas's, which is called
One Move at a Time.
Thank you. One Move at a Time.
Yes.
Yeah. So be sure to sub to those as well. Yeah. And I mean, definitely what you say in terms of like needing to understand the opening repertoires, understand the moves. This is something that's come up fairly frequently. Personally, I have no interest in building my own repertoire. But one thing I have noticed is like it's striking in the modern engine age how often like the best engine move is not the main line. You know, even for just us potsers looking at a computer, it's shocking, because that means if you just like you have to decide between following what the engine says is the best move or following what all the grandmasters have played over time. And obviously with engines getting stronger than ever, I just before our interview saw someone quoting Daniel Dubov talking about how he can't believe how much stronger engines have gotten in just the past 3 years.
So
it's a brave new world, and sort of parallel to what we were talking about with like chess publishing changing, like, you know, the rate of change is accelerating, I think, in terms of how openings are being learned.
There are examples of this every week, like in the Women's World Cup, I think Nana Zagnidze, she played 5h6, I think that was her, in an open Sicilian. Now this is a move that, like, you know, if you showed Spassky this or you showed Fischer this, they'd fall over laughing, right? I mean, this is not a move that classical chess logic likes, but Stockfish thinks it's okay. And if Stockfish thinks it's okay today, you play it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, an example from the Russian championship that this will be on Chess Life Online by the time this podcast drops, but it'll also be a very abbreviated version in the December issue of Chess Life. There's a game from the Russian championship by Nikita Vituvakov. I don't know that's how you pronounce his name, but it sounds right. Where his opponent played like a near novelty in a Catalan sort of position on move 8. And because Stockfish likes the move, Vituvakov was prepared for it all the way through move 23. I mean, like, this is where opening preparation is right now. And you know, if you watch it, you can almost even track it in terms of like when a new Stockfish comes out, suddenly new openings become viable again. Mm-hmm. And you can see it in the top players. Like they, I mean, you live and die by the engine. It's crazy. You know, for me, that's why, by the way, like I kind of like the Botvinnik games, because I'm going to go back and play these old openings that like make sense to humans. Cause I just, my brain doesn't work any other way. My brain might not work, period, but at least I have hope of playing some of these Nimzo lines, right, that are, you know, so sharp that the engine has to show you everything. It's getting old sucks, man.
Yeah.
it's not easy.
Yeah, I'm with you. And John, of course, you're also known for, as you alluded to in the presentations you've done for Killer Chess Training, your sort of knowledge of chess computers and chess engines. So what changes should we be aware of in that landscape? I mean, I guess I'm sure you got the new Stockfish with, you know, without contempt and all that. But any other new developments in chess technology?
Well, I mean, you know, Stockfish, as I think most people who follow it know, they've incorporated like a mini neural network. So it's what used to be the handcrafted evaluation, like, you know, trying to quantify what an open file is worth and trying to program that into a chess engine. They've gotten rid of just about all of that, and now the engine's evaluation has been learned through data, through billions and billions of computer evaluations. So by now, Stockfish is like, you know, is now definitely by far the strongest engine that ever was, and it keeps getting better. Leela is kind of stagnant. They have not really figured out how to improve it that much. So I think there may be a new revolution coming there. I just don't know when. Certainly that, you know, Leela is still really important for top players to reference, but it's Stockfish has kind of gotten so good that they, I think, you know, if you have a laptop that just doesn't have a graphics card to run Leela, you're going to be okay. And then the computer hardware race, I mean, my God, you know, you could go crazy trying to build a chess computer to keep up with the Sam Shanklins of the world. And I did that a little bit. You can see it right back there. As we can see each other. So yeah, my not such a big beast, but kind of big beast is sitting back there. And
but you said Sam Shanklin was using a cloud-based engine, like, because we should say for listeners, you can subscribe to like super powered engines. Like, I think Anish Giri was recently signed a deal with Chessify. Yeah,
yep. Which Chessify, it can be expensive. I mean, you know, but at the same time, you're also getting access to much harder, much faster hardware than you could possibly build on your own. Top players today, some of them will use that. I think most of them, and I'm sure Giri is among these people, they have a computer stashed away somewhere in the world, like a really powerful computer that they can remotely access. So that's what Shanklin does. And that's what, for example, Maxime Vachier-Legrave, who wrote our cover story for December. He talks about how he got to St. Louis before the Sinkfield Cup. He got there like 2 weeks early. And so some people might wonder, well, okay, if he's there by himself, how's he going to train? How's he going to get ready? And he says, well, okay, I've got remote access to my supercomputer and, you know, all I need is my laptop.
But with Sam and with MVL, it's their own, they own these supercomputers?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, when I say supercomputer, I don't mean like, you know, like the kind of thing that like the US government or the Chinese government owns, that they're, you know, 80,000 CPUs and things like that. But people are building really powerful machines with the AMD Threadripper, which can get up to 64 cores and can have...
Too much computer speak, John. You got to slow it down for
basically,
us.
So a CPU, a central processing unit, is the thing that crunches the numbers. It's the thing that basically the engine uses to turn a position into something that it can evaluate and can find moves in. It used to be that you would have one CPU in a computer. Now they've built computer chips that have multiple CPUs on them. So my computer back there has 16 cores built into its processing unit, which means that it can do 16 things at once, or it can devote 16 of those threads, or 32 threads, depending on hyper-threading, to the task. So right now, like this machine in the opening position, it looks at 23 or 24 million positions per second. For a normal human being like me, who, you know, it's overkill. I do not need that kind of processing power, except for my job. It helps. For Sam Shanklin, that's not enough.
Yeah.
Shanklin's got a much faster machine. And I'm sure like Caruana has an even faster machine. You know, that's what these guys have to do. It's like a technological arms race, and they just have to do it to keep up with each other.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's one of the reasons among a million others, but the World Championship, I always feel like it's like it's like a barometer for that moment in opening theory. Like what are these guys going to play, you know, after they've gathered all of the brightest minds and, you know, most high powered machines in the world, trying to eke out some sort of edge or at least fertile ground for exploration. You know, what will we see on the board in 1 month from basically less than a month from when we record this?
And here's a funny story about that, about Nepomniachtchi and computers. So when he won the candidates, we got an email, like a press release from a Russian computer firm in Skolkovo, I think it's called. It's like the... It's been explained to me as essentially like the Russian Silicon Valley, and they are one of his sponsors. And so we got this press release saying, oh, you know, he used our supercomputer to do analysis for the candidates. And isn't that great? And so me being the computer nerd I am, I wrote them back and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Can you give me more details? And like, I gave him a list of questions like, you know, how powerful was the computer? Did you guys do custom coding to help him with it? What did it all look like? And they said, oh, we'll get back to you. And then they said, yeah, we can't tell you anything because yeah, the sponsors don't want you to know. And I was like, okay. So he must've really had access to some powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure Magnus is in exactly the same boat. I mean, you know, more, they're probably contributing more to global warming than anyone, with all these computers running.
Yeah. It'll be fascinating to see. So, you and I both have been trying to line up coverage for the upcoming World Championship. I'll have announcements on that soon. There's going to be some bonus Perpetual Chess podcast, but what does CLO have lined up?
Yeah, so we
Chess Life Online.
We sort of piloted this a little bit for our US Championship coverage. And what we've decided to do is try to have a guest annotator for every game, or well, in the World Championship, it'll be for every game. In the US Championship, it was like a game of the day or a couple games of the day. And we have lined up some pretty interesting names, some players who might surprise you in terms of their willingness to write for us. So I won't give any away because nothing is, you know, set in stone. But yeah, look to CLO for daily coverage of the World Championship, including guest annotators by some of America's top players.
All right. Sounds excellent. Okay. And John, I think we've hit the major topics I wanted to. Anything else that you have on your agenda?
Yeah. So I did want to make one announcement. And first of all, I do want to sort of beg forgiveness from the listeners if I've been too ranty. You know, I got a lot of feelings and I want to share them with y'all. But one thing that we're doing that's really cool that sort of came out of me looking at the chess publishing landscape and being frustrated, frankly, is a joint venture with the Chess Journalists of America that should be announced by the time this pod drops. What we're doing, for those who don't know, the Chess Journalists of America, or the CJA, is basically like a trade association for people who write about chess or people who are somehow involved in chess publishing. And they have a website. They have had a journal in the past, although that may not be true going forward just because, you know, a website seems more pertinent. They do some historical work, so interviews with older players. But one of the main things they do is awards every year. So, and, you know, this year we didn't get Best Magazine, but we did get the lion's share of the awards from the CJ. And I was very happy to have that happen. We're going to start like a continuing education program with the CJA for chess journalists, anyone who is a CJA member, but also for US chess state affiliates, because a lot of them have like a state magazine or a state website where they publish state news. And we want to give them the tools to sort of take that to the next level. So we're going to be offering webinars on things like, I think I'm going to do the first one about like a style guide. And why a style guide is important and how to work that into your editing process. We're going to have things about design. So like journal design, design principles. American Chess Magazine, by the way, has in principle agreed to join us in this venture. So we're going to be getting, you know, as many of the top tier people we can to get involved with this. And the goal really is to help, you know, help anyone who wants to publish anything in chess do a better job of it. But also maybe to grow the field of chess writers, which selfishly I would really like to see because you know, that gives me more opportunity to hire people for Chess Life. So that is coming and I'm really excited about it. I hope anyone who's listening still at this point who has any interest will either sign up for the CJA or keep a look on their website because we will have announcements for that coming soon.
Okay, excellent.
We also might do some stuff with podcasts for that, by the way, for people who are interested in podcasting.
Okay.
Not to compete with you, but just to, you know, do their own thing.
I approve. awesome. All right. So, and people, of course, can follow you on Twitter.
I'm on the Twitter's Hartman Chess.
Okay. And your email address is public as well, correct?
john.hartman@uschess.org.
Excellent. Okay. And John, it's been great to catch up. Glad to hear that US Chess is propelling forward as expected.
we're hurling ourselves into the future. I like
that. Yes, exactly. Always good to talk chess with you, John.
Ben, as always, it's a pleasure. And let's not wait another 2 years for it to be number five, okay?
All right.
Thanks, Ben.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be a member of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Be sure to check out their sports and pop culture related podcasts as well. I also, as always, would like to thank Matthew Passy for producing the show. Without Matthew, Perpetual Chess would not exist. And I want to thank everyone who listens to the show, whether it be on your own without telling anyone about it, keeping it secret, or if you're helping to spread the word, all the better, whether it be telling a friend about a particularly impactful interview or whether it be writing a positive review online. All of that stuff helps get the word out and helps Perpetual Chess continue to grow. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those that provide financial support to Perpetual Chess. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible in its current form. And I would like to give special thanks to the following people and entities. Here comes the list. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of Lasman Chess, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adaptive Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprenchess Twitch channel, Anidi Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Hee, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, I am Dimitri Schneider, Douglas Wilson, I am Eric Rosen, Farhan Tharwar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Hampus Axelson, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin Gilmore, Kevin O'Callaghan, Kevin Pryor, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oplin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Michael Sullivan, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, Perry McManus, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Ray Lillywhite, Reuven Fisher, Rick Rivas, Robert Hansen, Ross Crossland, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following, hashtag ChessPunks, who are the adult improvers on Chess Twitter, Ace Vallega, Adam Fowler, Adam Johansson, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio Leonfort, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Gruber, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brandon Halseed, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Bruno Johnson, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Ken Kabadayi, Chad Hilton, Chad Likens of Rose City Chess in Portland, the Chess Dojo, Chess for Charity Jacksonville, Chess Patzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Best, Dave Saylor, David Blaskacek, David Brown, David Gores, David Hamblin, David Cramley, David Peterson, Dennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Eric Baldwin, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Mayo Perea, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letard Lavoie, Frank Tortoris, MD, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Foote, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Gregory Higgins, Han Schut, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jay Tuttle, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeff Davis, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Jones, Jim Ratliff, Jim Sadler, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almaguer, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Bannister, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Justin Goodfellow, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reifert, Lars Wiesen, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emiljanova, aka Photo Chess, Mark Chaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Butolovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matt Ferrari, Matthew Coughlin, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, Pablo Davila, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Eckert, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randall Montgomery, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard McCormick, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Turner, Robert Wall, Robert Wilson, Rory Coleman, Ryan Berg, Samson Teaches Chess, Satyajit Malagu, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwater, Sergey Makagon, Seth Ruzica, Seth Will, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Simon Schmidt, Stefan Roller, Stephen Miller and Tom George, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Terry King, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Beauchamp, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, Zachary Hoskin, and Zhivkor Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Podcast Network.